Mackenzie.
Lamar.
Because we have not taken the time this week to discuss a new name, Novemberg rolls on. Loud, proud week two. We're back and covering Catch Me If You Can. And obviously lots of lying in this film, lots of lies about this film, real life, fake, all this crazy stuff. But my question is, if you had to work a new job starting tomorrow, something you've never done before, and you had to fly under the radar of not standing out and people actually thinking you were capable of doing what you were doing. And I guess there should be a caveat here. It should be something that is skilled. Like you take home whatever salary you get from this job. So you're not allowed to pick something that's super easy to do. But what do you think you would do?
I feel like I'm just faking it till I make it in my current job, but I was told that that's against the rules. So I can't use that one. No. Let's see. I think this is the first thing that popped in my head. I haven't really fully fleshed this out, but the first thing that popped in my head was a mechanic. Cause I feel like it is pretty skilled and I can do a lot of the basics that would get me by. And in the age of YouTube, especially, I can look other shit up and figure out how to do it probably without calling too much attention to myself. I think like if I worked at a little, you know, like a Jiffy Lube or something, I could.
I feel like 80% of Jiffy Lube is just oil changes.
Right. So. Like I can do oil changes like that, like crank them out. I could work at Brake Check. Like I can do all the brake jobs, you know, so put me
and
in
at
a Jiffy
the end,
Lube.
You just have to remember to like ask, so do you want us to change this filter for you? Like,
do you want me to do your cabin air filter for $175? Yeah, I can rip people off with the best of them. Yeah, for sure. For sure. So I think I could pull it off. I think I could pull that off for at least a hot minute. I mean, until there was like a big job maybe. And even then I've done some bigger jobs. Like I've done some transmission repairs, some engine rebuilds, and those are hard, don't get me wrong, but like I muddled my way through them, so I feel like I could do it.
Like I didn't even think of the how much you can do with YouTube these days,
you know. Oh god, you can learn everything. I mean almost everything. You just stick in your car model and you go how to do blah blah blah, and 90% of it you can figure out. That's been fun fact, another like goal side project of mine is like a YouTube channel of like for women, how mechanics, like how to do basic repair jobs at home. Because a lot of women don't want to watch like dudes mansplain things to them. So at least I sure don't. So anyway, yeah, I feel like I could limp along for a while. There would probably be some job that outed me at some point for sure.
Nice. Very cool.
What about you?
Maybe it's just because I have Jurassic Park on the brain, but I feel like it's not too hard to be a paleontologist. You dig, you dust. Once you hit something, you dust it off. If a kid
just
comes around
asking,
just
the guy who couldn't think of a single fucking dinosaur in the Jurassic Park episode. He's like,
Tyrannosaurus Rex.
What I could fake is being a paleontologist, and I know none of these terms.
But no,
you're just like your side googling while you're digging, like
Google would help for sure. I would just look up different types of dinosaurs and be like,
Google
yeah,
lens the shape of the bones. Like I can figure this out.
Or like, you know, my other favorite part of the job would be if a child speaks up and asks stupid questions, you can basically threaten physical harm on them. I like that component of the
kind of have the raptor
job.
Claw on hand. But yeah, for sure. For
I
sure.
think. My real answer might be, though, there are so many damn coaches on NFL teams. There's so many assistant coaches, special teams coaches, line coaches.
Offensive line.
I feel like
line.
I could fake one of those pretty easily.
Special
like, okay,
teams.
The guy's going to throw
the
ball
one.
To you. Here's how you catch. Yeah, special teams. You kick
Nobody
it. Go
knows
through
what
the
special teams coach actually does. Yeah, like you just, you can plug right in there for sure.
Yeah. Meeting's over early, guys. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. See you Sunday.
I'm just waiting for the inundation of comments we're about to get on our talking shit about the NFL. I love the NFL, guys. Don't come for me. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are continuing Novemberg, I say with hesitation. Ooh. And a little bit of disdain, but actually
out of your mouth, you can't put it back in.
I can't put it back in. Spielberg month, Novemberg, with a hard left turn from last week. Catch Me If You Can. Mm-hmm. And I said it at the end of the ep last week, and I'll say it again. I think it's one of the many indicators of Mr. Spielberg's range. Very different film, and he does it well, because of course he does.
Yeah, anyway. I give him props for just variety after looking through when we, even when we were selecting which four movies do we want to do this month. And it's just, yeah, he does a little bit of everything, even has his hand in with writing and producing and all that, obviously. But we watched Poltergeist during October and he didn't direct that, but he helped write it and like oversaw the whole thing. And it's just, he does these little things really well.
Yeah, he does have incredible range. He has things that he doesn't do great when he tries to, I think, face them head on. Like he can't do, I don't think he can play a straight comedy super well, but he does like incidental comedy really well, you know?
Yeah.
So this is one of those where like, this is not a comedy, but it's super funny, you know? Mm-hmm. So anyway, he does a really great job. But before, we're already getting away with ourselves. What are we drinking today? I named this one, so I thought it was pretty punny, but what's in it?
It's a pretty good name. We'll get there. So it's 2 ounces of gin, 0.75 ounces of lemon, half an ounce of simple, 0.25 ounces of OJ, and then 3 dashes of orange bitters. You're going to shake that up, put it into a coupe, and then you're going to top it with Prosecco, which is one of your favorite go-tos. I know you love the bubbles. And what are we calling this?
This is a French 75 to life.
Very good play on words.
Thank you. If y'all don't remember from this movie, France plays a role, hence why we're here. But I will also say, pro tip on this drink, I do love the bubbles, but if you don't want to waste a whole fucking bottle of bubbles for these, I get these little baby guys. And this is what I use for when I'm putting them in cocktails. So you can make a couple cocktails with this without like wasting a whole giant bottle.
Smart.
This is the La Marca, which I really like. Please sponsor us. But there are other mini bubble bottles if you want them. So
we're already saying like 80% of their name every week. So right? We should be sponsored already. We're doing most of the work.
They're really behind. So anyway, cheers.
Cheers.
What's your review on this one? You weren't a fan because the other one because it had Aperol, which is
this one's tasty. I like this better than the Jurassic Park cocktail. I think Aperol just, like I said, overpowers most everything. It's for my taste buds anyway. I can never not taste it. This one I like it a lot.
Yeah, I think I like the little topper with Prosecco, and not just like, pro tip. Yeah, you top it. You don't mix it in.
It's also a Saturday afternoon. It's a nice little Saturday sipper. Not too strong, light, but almost like a brunchy type beverage.
Yeah, it is kind of brunchy. That's true. It's nice. And I'm not a huge gin person. And this is where we got to call out Craft World again, Skylar, because he's the only person who I trust to make me gin drinks. I'm not saying that other people don't do it well, but it's so inconsistent where I can just taste way too much of the gin. And this, like for you with the Aperol, like when gin overpowers something for me, it's almost ruined. But these are always like on point. All right, homies. So this is, what's the verdict on a spoiler-free versus not for this one? I feel like not. It's 22 years old.
I guess we could make, there would be a couple, even before we get into the cast and the crew, like all I will say before we get to spoiler territory is that I think for me, when I first saw this, a lot of the appeal was that it was based on a true story, right? This guy, Frank Abagnale Jr. and his book and his experiences.
Inspired by a true story.
Yeah, I guess that's a better
distinction. Yeah.
Better way to put it, because in, I think, 2021 was when it came out that nearly every con that he talks about in his book was exaggerated, embellished, or completely made up. Not to say that he wasn't committing bank fraud and that he wasn't in prison and even locked up in foreign prisons. That stuff happened. But that takes something away for me when I rewatch this, because I think some films do lean heavily on the fact, if you found out The Social Network wasn't true at all, I don't think it's as good of a film. Like, it's still compelling in some ways and entertaining. If you found out Molly's Game was not true in any, and it was just like, oh yeah, I hosted 2 celebrity poker games, that's all that really happened.
Right.
That takes away for me from, and I tried to watch it this time and just watch it as fiction, and it's still entertaining, still witty, still great character work by DiCaprio and Hanks, but I'm going to have a hard time rating this one strongly just because that took away my enjoyment from the film. Just saying that up front.
Yeah, I love this movie. I have always loved this movie. It's a great time, but asterisk, I have not rewatched it since I became aware of a lot, like how much of it was false. We knew a lot of it was embellished. We knew like the relationship with his dad was embellished and things like that. Some of those things were already known, but the degree to which it had been fabricated was not clear until very recently. And I had not rewatched it since. And I will say, same here, that took away from this on rewatch for me as well, because I just kept being like, that's not true. And that's not true. I think if you went into this not knowing a thing about it and you had never ever known that it was based on or inspired by a true story, then it's a great film. Yeah. It's just a good time. It's really well done. But yeah, I think it is kind of hard when you go on the roller coaster of this is inspired by this real person and he exists today and all these things are true about him and blah, 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 blah. And then you go, yeah, through this roller coaster of realizing a lot of it's not.
And none of that's on Spielberg, by the way.
No. You know, like I said, the filmmaking is independent of that for sure. Yeah.
We haven't even gotten into what's the release year on this? 2002. So, yeah, this stuff didn't come out until 3 years ago. This is a two-decade-old film. So, none of this is on Spielberg, and I'm not going to critique him at all today. I like to compare this while rewatching it. I went, this is kind of like a early PG-13 version of Wolf of Wall Street. It's like kind of what Leo would go on to do of playing this sort of hateable, but like sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Scrappy individual. But yeah, I think Wolf of Wall Street eventually perfected on that. And I don't know how much of that is made up, exaggerated, embellished, but I feel like that does it a little better.
There's a good amount of embellishment there as well, but the bones are correct. I think I agree. Like, I think it's interesting that Leonardo DiCaprio plays the character throughout from a time where he's supposed to be very young and he looks very young. And then as he ages, he still always looks young, but he looks a little bit older. And I think it helps you at least tethered to the fact that he started doing this when he was a kid and you feel a little bit more empathy for him. Yeah. But I agree. Yeah. It is a kind of like a Wolf of Wall Street phase 1 kind of character for him.
And props to that dude for, like, you know, I think that's the ultimate con, right? Like, I lied about these things about lying and I made millions off of it. Good on him.
That was gonna be my next point of like, does that actually end up complimenting the film in some way? That he took us all for a ride again.
Yeah.
And also that he does own this firm and is a specialist in these areas, and like he's just a con man and he's gotten away with most of his life doing the same thing over and over. So anyway, we'll get into it. But yeah, let's do some basics. Turn around, don't drown. It's spoiler time. Catch Me If You Can, like we said, 2002. The ratings are very high. The IMDb is 8.1 out of 10. And the critics have it at 96%. And the audience has it at 89%, which I think is pretty fair analysis on the whole, the watching experience and the production experience and all of that. Kind of in alignment with, you know, I think where I would have been on first watch, especially too. So I think it kind of makes sense. Obviously directed by Mr. Steven Spielberg, which, and as we said last week, if you didn't hear, we're not going to list his entire filmography every single week. There's too much. We're going to just mention a couple as we go. So some of his that you may not remember off the top of your head are Lincoln. I think that's one that is like was a big release, but also people don't always remember him for it. They remember Daniel Day-Lewis more than anything else.
I didn't see it. I heard it was good.
It was very well done and very long. Yes, exactly. Saving Private Ryan is another long one.
I feel like you're also subtly, because we don't typically announce our whole release schedule in advance. So by naming these, I feel like you're subtly, people are like, oh,
what
they're not going to do Saving
Private Missing? I sure am. Thanks for picking up on that. That is what I'm doing every week. Let's see what the people guess. Maybe we'll have a poll on Instagram and be like, what are we going to cover? Well,
we're not doing Save by Ryan, but that is a good one. And that is
I mean, fun fact, guys, while we're on it, while we're talking about it, we nixed that one because we felt like it's so good that it would be hard to find flaws with it. Not that there are none, but that there would maybe be, it'd be hard to find flaws on rewatch. And
not like that piece of shit Jurassic Park.
Not that piece of shit Jurassic Park that we loaded on. No, we just thought like it maybe wouldn't make for that interesting of an episode. It's also,
and right, I think to your point of, you've said before that there's lots of people have said a lot of things about Saving Private Ryan.
And it's one that's been talked about a lot and for good reason, for sure. But we're trying to do ones that we don't think are talked about quite as much. So
we also hate Matt Damon.
We also hate Matt Damon. Fuck that guy. Just kidding. I love Matt Damon.
Have
anyway,
you done any Matt Damon films?
You know, I don't think we have than like we've adjacent referenced him a lot. Like we referenced him talking about The Martian. We've talked about Good Will Hunting. We've talked about his cameos in the Marvel movies, but we've never done anything, any of his actual movies.
So far, my theory holds up.
Yeah. I think we need a Matt Damon month. Come on. He's great. So we'll get there, guys. But real quick, the writers on this, obviously Frank Abagnale Jr.'s source material is credited as part of the writing. He did that with Stan Redding. That's when you need a book chaperone to help you write a book because you've never done it before, folks, for those of you who don't know. And then Jeff Nathanson is the screenplay here. So he adapted that novel and he changed a few things in concert with Steven Spielberg. Like Steven Spielberg wanted some major, not major, but like impactful story changes, like the relationship with his father being ongoing and him coming back to visit him and continually writing him and things like that. That was Steven Spielberg felt like that relationship being a through line was important. So that some of those edits were made in the screenplay process for sure.
And Jeff Nathanson hasn't done a ton. I mean, he's done some and he tends to work with Spielberg. Like he did The Terminal. Yeah. He did one of the Pirates of the Caribbean, but it was one of the later like Dead Men Tell No Tales, I think, which not a lot of people saw. And then he did the 2019 Lion King, which I thought was interesting.
Which was like real bad.
I didn't see it. And he also has done like some random sequels. I forget what the franchises were, but he did a lot of number two in action films, which doesn't, to me, lend a lot of credibility to
reflect well on him. Yeah. We don't need it to be great. We just need a warm body. Like just write
it
some
sounds
shit.
To me, based on what you said, that it was basically just like Steven Spielberg was like, I don't feel like typing this. You over there.
You go fix this. Make these Here you changes. Go. Yeah. Well, I will say too, like The Lion King was real bad because Beehive don't come for me, but like Beyonce is not an actress. Like, can we just put that shit to bed? Like, she's not here. She should not be acting in things. Like, she can sing. She's incredible at producing films, like works of art in her long form music videos, but she is not an actress. And she was like bad in an animated film. Like, that's saying a lot, I think, to be bad in that. And just on the whole, like the CGI and all this stuff was like, I just didn't think it was well done.
We're currently at a 5.0 rating on Spotify and we are going to get bombarded.
We're going to get fucking shredded. Yeah. Well, it doesn't, again, Beyonce is great, but she's not perfect. Like, can we have one thing that she can't do well? Because I think this is the thing. I think we found the thing. Anyway, I love her. She seems great, but not for that. Moving on to our major cast and crew before I get us to a one star on Spotify. Leonardo DiCaprio is our lead here, Mr. Frank Abagnale Jr. He has done so many fucking things. Like, this is a Spielberg moment in and of itself of like, what do I even list? But he, of course, is famous for Titanic, The Aviator, Wolf of Wall Street, which you mentioned, The Departed, Shutter Island, which I think is a fun, like, not his most famous film, but a really good one of his. What's Eating Gilbert Grape? Like, I could go on and on and on. He's done a million things and he's just fucking great.
And this one comes at an interesting time where it's 5 years post Titanic, because he was already pretty famous in the early 90s with Gilbert Grape. And then it sort of, he grew, did Romeo and Juliet, did Titanic in 97. And then I don't know if there was a backlash or if he was just hesitant to take role, because I think he only did one or two other movies between that and this. Yeah. And then this and Gangs of New York come out in the same year. And from then on, Leo is fucking everywhere and has killed it for the last two decades.
I think he has said before, I could be misremembering this, but I feel like I heard something about this way back of just like he needed a break because Titanic was such a behemoth, not only as a project, but, you know, the media frenzy and the obsession about it was really profound. And he was just like, I need to take a fucking breather and get out of the limelight. And then, yeah, he came back with two winners right in a row. Like, honestly, incredible stuff. So he's awesome. Another awesome gem, America's dad, Mr. Tom Hanks, makes an appearance as Carl Hanratty. And he, of course, again, has done a gazillion amazing things. Forrest Gump, Green Mile, Castaway, Philadelphia, which I don't know if that's a deep cut, but I feel like I don't know a ton of people have seen it. And if you haven't, you should. Also recently in Elvis, Sully, all kinds of things. He's just done fucking
everything.
I didn't
like Elvis. Did not enjoy Elvis.
I know we've talked about this. I feel like that's one we need to do on the pod because I loved Elvis and I feel like we should hash it out. But his character is very interesting in that. And he's a really divisive character in that. So, but I love that he plays so many different things. He has such range.
Did you read the deets about the original casting plan for this and why Tom Hanks wasn't even supposed to be in this originally?
Yeah, he was asked kind of at the last minute, and Spielberg didn't want to ask him. He just thought this is too small of a role for someone with the tenure and experience of Tom Hanks. And Tom Hanks basically told him, he was like, listen, a good role is a good role. And this is a great role.
It's not as though he's a supporting character.
Yeah.
It's the second main, like it's a two-person
job. I mean, he's technically
job.
A supporting actor, but he is integral to the story.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it doesn't happen without him, you know?
Facts. So it's interesting. The original casting plan was to have Johnny Depp was Spielberg's first choice for the DiCaprio role in this. But they ended up going with Leo. However, Gangs of New York was filming at the same time. That got delayed in shooting. And they had cast James Gandolfini to play the Tom Hanks role in this. But because of that delay in shooting, he couldn't do it. He had to get back onto the set of The Sopranos. And I feel like that's a good alternate history of how different would things be if James Gandolfini had played opposite Leo in this.
And I think he's the wrong guy, actually. And I don't say that just because of Tom. I say that because he brings fundamentally a very different energy than not just Tom, but like it seems like the Carl Hanratty character. Because if you read about it too, people are like, if you saw the guy that this is based off of, you know, Tom Hanks had found footage and like figured out how, they're like, it's like seeing him move. It's like seeing the same guy. And I just think James Gandolfini, while a great actor, brings with him a very specific persona that is just not the same. And I don't think that would have translated here as well.
I think, you're right. I feel like this could have been a breakout role for him though, to break out of that mold of like, he's not only Tony Soprano, because I mean, he did some film
but
work.
Would he
Sopranos.
Have? Because I've seen him, like, did you see The Drop? He's the same fucking guy. Like he's in, and it's not actually that he's playing the same guy in the same character. It's that he as a person has a baseline, and I think his baseline is fundamentally different than this one. And not that he should only ever be cast as a mobster type. I don't mean that. I just mean this domineering persona, this very strong character, this bulldozer type. Like, I think all of those kinds of things just come with him as a person. And Tom Hanks has the ability to take a step back and play it a little bit more straight than that, I guess, is kind of what I'm saying. It's not that I think he would read as a mobster. I don't mean that. I just
Fair point.
He would interact with other people in the scenes so much differently is all.
Yeah.
But anyways, I think that would have been a very interesting, like you said, alternate history. And yeah, maybe it would have been one of those moments where we see an actor like really upend their typecasting. Who knows? Another one who is always just playing himself, Mr. Christopher Walken, Frank Abagnale Sr. He has, of course, incredible filmography as well. But I think there, again, is just this through line of like, it's Christopher Walken, you know. He played the Deer Hunt. He was in Deer Hunter. He was in Seven Psychopaths, which if you haven't
seen,
Seven
Psychopaths
is so fucking good. And I think like not enough people have seen that. So if you haven't seen it, see it. It's great. He's great in it. Blast from the Past. This is a weird deep cut, but I include it because
Fraser.
Yeah, but he says something. We'll get there. But like he says the same line in the both movies. And then Sleepy Hollow as the Headless Horseman. And then Ants as Cutter, which we've talked before about like Ants versus Bug's Life. And I was like an Ants kid. And he was in Ants as Cutter. Did you have any other Christopher Walken faves?
I think I will always, from a comedy perspective, I will always love his role in Joe Dirt. It's such a dumb comedy film, but he in it is incredible. And then Man on Fire.
Why am I having deja vu about that? Have we talked about that before?
Did we talk about Joe Dirt? I feel like we did reference a joke or something in it, but I don't recall what episode.
I don't know if it was Christopher Walken or not. Sorry. Anyway, yeah, I just had a deja vu moment.
But yeah, Man on Fire with Denzel Washington. He's got a really small part in that, but I think he played. But to what you said earlier, like, yes, we're always going to see Christopher Walken, who has this very interesting, unique delivery. But in this, I think he gets a couple of really compelling monologues where he gets to show off more of his acting chops. So I think this was one of the ones where I went, oh, shit, Walken's a pretty good actor.
Yeah, I think that's true. He gets a little bit more material here than his typical, kind of like his monologue in Pulp Fiction, where he like gets a good stretch to talk and not just be a shtick of himself, you know, the way that he talks and his cadence and all that. I feel like sometimes in certain films, not all, they just sort of put him to work in that way rather than really.
Yeah,
like you said,
I would actually go the inverse there. I would think that Pulp Fiction is a perfect example of we need this person to deliver this very void of emotion monologue where it's this kind of insane story, but it's getting us to this backstory on this character and how this and this watch and how it got there. So I feel like that's to me in my
head.
I
don't mean his devoid of emotion thing. It's just like his cadence, the way that he talks is what people like put him to work for. Yes. And I feel like in Pulp Fiction though, like that contextually made a lot of sense, right? Like it tells you a lot about this person and this character. It's not just this type of delivery for the sake of this type of delivery is what I mean. And I feel like they put him to work in so many movies where like, he's just kind of the joke, you know, he's kind of part of the joke of himself is his presentation and his delivery. And I like that he doesn't do that here. You're totally right.
Not in this. That I mean, there's a scene I'll call out later where he nails it. Fucking nails
it. Totally. Martin Sheen, another great gem of a person, plays Roger Strong. He's an interesting character here. We'll get to him, but he's been in a bunch of things. He did The Departed. He was in Badlands. He's known most famously, I think, historically for Apocalypse Now. Mm-hmm. And of course, The West Wing, which he was on for a bazillion years as President Bartlett. And yeah, he's a fun one.
I wrote down that this is 4 years before him and Leo did The Departed together, but I want to segue that into, why do you think this is the only movie that Leo and Tom Hanks have ever done together? Is there anything to that?
I don't know that there's anything to that. That would be interesting, an interesting rabbit hole to go down, but they don't interact a ton on screen here. You right. know, there's not a lot of them in the same room at the same time. So I don't think it would be anything as far as clashing on set or anything like that. And maybe they just didn't jive because they just spent so little time together, I think, on the whole. But I also think like Spielberg brought them together and maybe he just needs to bring them together again. Because Tom Hanks is like practically Spielberg's muse, you know, at this point. Yeah. He puts them in everything. So I think they could bring them together more because, they're a real powerhouse. Again, even though they're not on the screen together as often, they play off of each other so well, even over the phone, you know, in this application. It's just, it's very well done. Also, we have Nathalie Bay, who is Paula Abagnale. She's probably not super well known to most American audiences. A lot of her work seems to be like French film. But she's done Lawrence Anyways, An Affair of Love. And then she also appeared in Downton Abbey, which maybe people might know her for a little bit later on. And then finally, Amy Adams, who this is a little bit earlier in her career. I wouldn't say like she's a breakout at this point. She's known, but she's not like a breakout star. She plays Brenda Strong, and she since then has done some incredible stuff. Arrival, which I personally love.
Really liked
her. That is surprising. We need a sidebar on that, Mr. I Hate Sci-Fi. American Hustle, Enchanted, The Fighter, Man of Steel, Julia and Julia. Like, she's another one of those actresses who I just think has such range. And she's been nominated for 27 fucking Oscars. And I don't think she still hasn't won. But she's incredible.
And even with braces, you know.
Even with braces, but hey, they come off, you know, and I love that he's like, no, I think your smile looks great with braces. And I'm like, boy, you lying. Like nobody, I had braces for years. Nobody loves a braces smile.
I thought you were going to, did we give a spoiler warning already? We did, right?
We did.
I thought you were going to when she gets them off and she's like, I keep rubbing my tongue over my teeth, like all up in his face. And it's just like,
I know, girl, we'll get to that scene too. And the direction she was given in that scene was a good time. But music, I gotta say it again. I did this last week. I will do it again. Mr. John fucking Williams, as usual, just wrecking shop. It is so good. And it is so different. Like if you want to just compare Jurassic Park and Catch Me If You Can, as far as scores and music styles, like this is more jazzy and like higher energy. So like, it's just a very different feel to this score, and he again just crushes it.
It's scored to me almost like a 70s like a spy thriller.
I think that's intentional.
It's a lot of low horns and a bit of jazz to it. I dig it.
It's like the man from Uncle and James Bond had a baby, and like this is what came out, and it's as far as score, and then even stylistically speaking, like Man from Uncle is very similar in that stylistically speaking, and I mean the series as well as the film. So
in this situation, though, are they do they have a surrogate? The Man from Uncle and James Bond. I'm confused about the science.
We'll talk about it later. Okay, it's really okay, complicated. Yeah. Afterward. Okay, so we're going to get into a quick plot summary. Barely 17 yet, Frank is a skilled forger who has passed as a doctor, lawyer, and a pilot. FBI agent Carl becomes obsessed with tracking down the con man who only revels in the pursuit. Which I think does become a really important theme, both of those. Like, Carl's obsession and his need to just be chased. You know, like, Frank wants to be... This is how he's getting attention. This is how people are engaging with him. And he's hooked on the chase, I think, is what it becomes.
I mean, when we get to the last line of the film, that tells exactly what you're saying. So
yeah, totally. Very quick production note. This was a $52 million budget, and it made $352 million in theaters in its theatrical run, which is, I think, very impressive for a non-actiony, you know, Spielberg flick. You know, it's not Indiana Jones. It's not Jurassic Park. It's a character story, and still drew people out because it was so well done.
Yeah, it's interesting that they have sort of throughout this the parallels of him and James Bond, and we talked about spies. He's not that. He's a con man, but the way that they weave that story and make it interesting, where there's not a lot of action beats, but it's him just having these semi-tense interactions where you're not sure if he's going to give himself away or not. And it's honestly pretty low stakes when you think about the reality of the situation, but it's still really entertaining to see.
Yeah. And I think the thing with this one is that it is very intentionally an homage to those things. Right. And he even acknowledges as a character, his own obsession with those things. I mean, you see him wanting to dress like James Bond. He is likening himself to James Bond, and he gets the suit and he gets the car and he does all the things. And I think it's also indicative of his youth at this point, right? To now, he has been playing a game. He has been playing dress up, and he's not taking it seriously. And you hear him say things along those lines multiple times where he does not fully understand the gravity of the situation. And this is all, he's conning himself because he's treating this like it's a game of role play or dress up. He even says at one point that he's Mr. Fleming to his tailor.
Doesn't fucking read.
And the tailor doesn't read because he has no fucking reaction. And I'm like, James Bond, hello, the suit? Anyway, and like, he literally asked him to make the James Bond suit. Yeah. And the fucking tailor is just like over his head. No idea. But I think, it just speaks to how detached from reality he is, which I think can be early on, especially very much likened to like, he's a kid, he's a fucking kid.
That's what I was going to say. Attribute it to the youth of how invincible we all feel when we're that young.
Yeah. He just has not understood the gravity of everything that he's done. But I think from the very top, like, you get that tone of levity and cartoonishness with the title cards. They're beautifully done, and they're their own story in their own right. Like, it literally acts out the sequence of the film, but it does it in a way where, like, you don't know the story yet, especially on the first watch, you don't know the story yet, but it's so engaging, and it's got, and like, the music follows it so well. And I think, again, it likens it all to kind of a game, and I think that plays out in the film.
Yeah, I might be misremembering this, and this might be the first one that did it, but I feel like the aughts had a stretch where, like, a lot of like sequences for opening credits were animated, and maybe they were all ripping this off, but it felt like that became a thing for about a decade, where like every fifth movie you saw had sort of these interesting animated sequences. But I do like how it spins out of that. To your point, it sets a tone. We go right into this game show situation of them trying to guess who's
again
the
another
real Frank
game
Abagnale. Yeah, and I like that it jumps from the intro to that to then this framing device of him being arrested, and then we sort of spend the rest of the movie jumping back and forth. And yeah, I think it sets up the plot really well.
And just taking a quick step back to the titles, like, to your point, where you're like, I this trend of animated title cards. This is a James Bond trend. Like, this mm-hmm. is how James Bond titles open. And so it's, again, like hearkening back to that. I think it's telling you in so many ways, in so many words, what this is going to be. It's going to be a twist on a James Bond story. It's going to be a twist on this game and this chase and this, you know, especially the chase aspect of it. And I think it's subtle. Like, I think that's not super obvious the first time through, but it all comes together to make this really cohesive theme. And I do like that it opens with the game show. The only thing that kind of bugs me about that, and these are one of the few marks against this film for me, one is that it drags a little bit, and two, that it doesn't come back to that ever. And that is one of the few things that is absolutely true, did happen. He did make this appearance. And so I just wanted more of that. Like, just even if it's just, even if it was just interspersed snippets of that, like where we jump back and forth, because you do see a little bit of this time jump here and there. I wanted to just see that in, like, after this is all said and done, how does this guy behave on this show? Because you don't really get that footage. You don't get very much of that footage. And you get that one question, that one time. And it just feels like a loose end that's never tied up for me.
Yeah, it's a prologue, but doesn't really... You don't know that that's what it is.
Right. And it was, to be fair, the last thing filmed. Like, it was an add-on thing. It was not part of the original screenplay and script. So it, like, kind of makes sense. But yeah, I guess if you treat it like a prologue, it kind of works. It just, I don't know that it was necessary. It was interesting, but I don't know that it was necessary unless you were gonna do something more with it.
They probably could have. They have, I think, three questions that get asked, or even just two questions that get asked of the different Franks on stage. And maybe they could have set up the story a little more if they had probed a little bit more to get more of this insight to the character before we get into what we actually end up seeing in the past.
I just wish you got the moment where the actual contestant picks the wrong Frank Abagnale. Like, even if that's the only thing we came back to, because that's what happened. She picks the wrong one. She doesn't guess that it's him.
You probably could have closed the movie with that, honestly.
That's what I mean. Like, because isn't that like closing, isn't that putting on a bow the con, right? Like that he, like, this is the con, that he can get away with this even now. Like, people don't know who he is. And yeah, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of a bow to that little bit. But I do think it's an interesting opening on the whole.
We quickly get sort of established after that of who this character is, who his parents are, the influences in his life. And I know this is, I don't want to spend today going back and forth to how his life really was, how the book, what he said it was, how the movie ends up portraying it. I'm just going to stick to what the movie says. But in this, you know, his dad is a bad influence. Like, we can tell that his dad is also very savvy. He's street smart. He knows how to get what he wants out of people, but he's not great with money. He's in trouble with the IRS. He's losing his business. And so we see this really quick fall from grace. But I do enjoy, immediate in the first 5 minutes. It's like, oh, well, now we don't have a house. Think his life
is top of the world, and
he's
then
getting this award. Yes. But when he goes to the public school and that scene where he decides to just impersonate the substitute teacher just because it's like con man gonna con man, you know, that scene to me, more than anything else in like Leo DiCaprio from when he started until 2002, I think encapsulates what he would become acting wise. He just goes balls to the wall on that one sequence, embraces this teacher role, the confidence that he dismisses the other substitute that shows up. You look at things where he portrays in like Django Unchained and The Departed and all these other roles he would eventually take. And I think more so than Titanic or Gilbert Grape or any of those, I think that little classroom sequence really does show a lot of his range.
Totally. I mean, I think it's such a, it makes you immediately think of like, oh, I wish. Right? Like, but he has the balls to do it. And I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. Obviously, it doesn't necessarily turn out well. But imagine being able to get that revenge on this, you know, jock that just slammed you into a locker by just having the skill set to walk into a room with the confidence that he does and fucking take over. Yeah. And it's such a cool, fun energy. And it's a good allusion to what he will do later. And that all you need is a good story and a little bit of confidence, and you can take over the world.
You're supposed to be here there.
Yeah. Just like, like you said something jokingly about the imposter syndrome at the top. Like, I'm not kidding when I say like everybody has those moments where you have to fake it till you make it. Like, there have been so many times where I have gotten on client conversations or given a talk or given a speech or a performance or whatever it is. And I've just been like, you gotta just own it. You may not feel it, but you just gotta own it. And he does that. Like, he just comes in and he owns it. And that's why so many people are enraptured by him and believe him.
And when he gets caught, I love the line of, he's been doing it for 2 weeks and he was planning a trip to
a fucking French bread factory in Trenton, New Jersey. And I was just like, Trenton,
New Jersey. But, and then right after that, you know, his dad just chuckles with him. So again, he just has a bad influence in his life.
And you get no indicator that there are any repercussions, right? Like, right. His mom just shakes her head and she just moves on. She's a very like hands-off mom. You can tell. Yeah. She reminds me a lot of my grandma with my dad. Like, she was very like, you'll turn out fine. Like, I'm not worried, you know? And this is that same energy. And I think maybe might have been of the time too, like era based or just parenting of like, if you haven't killed someone or done something terrible, then I'm like not going to get involved and I wish you the best. And right. That's the
just
energy.
Just be gone before the streetlights go out. That's
right. And like, that's the energy that she gives. And then he gives the energy of like being a fan. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. He's like a fan of his son. You know, he's accepting the Rotary Club Award and he wants his son to stand up, but he wants them to applaud him. And he's like, right here in the front row, my son, you know, like, he's so proud of him as his baseline, which is both beautiful and problematic because it yields this hyper confident person who has had no repercussions to date and then just goes and fucking wreck shop and does this. And you even like, I agree. I don't want to go back and forth about what's real and what's not real, but one of the things that he says, or when he's been interviewed about this, is that what a great man his dad was. And he says like that that the movie gets it right finally, like on the edit of like treating him like he's a better guy and that there are previous stories or iterations or something that were like misrepresenting what a good man his dad was. And he's like, and here you get to see what a good man he was. And I was like, do we? Like, he has such a warped perception, I think, even of who his dad was, because I do feel like there's some truth to that dynamic.
Well, if you want a not so fun parallel of that, go listen to our Iron Claw episode and how,
oh my God, right?
The brother from that is like, same thing. My dad was a good man. Was he?
Yeah. Like, have you romanticized this in some way? And I'm sure you, especially like just for survival's sake, you kind of have to some degree. But, you know, when you have gotten away with con after con after con and your dad was a fan, like maybe that's your take, you know? That was crazy for me.
I wanted to, you mentioned when he started, I like that the impetus is kind of his parents are getting a divorce. Again, his life is kind of falling apart and they're trying to keep this facade in front of him, but eventually they can't anymore. And that's when he runs away and starts on all these sort of schemes. Yeah. And I like that with his initial attempts at bank fraud of like forging these checks and like trying to get money, like just he's doing it for the thrill and I think to kind of avoid what's waiting for him at home. I like that they don't work out initially. Like, he does take some trial and error of figuring out how to gain people's trust and why it's not working.
Yeah, I think it's good. I mean, that he, because not every con works. I mean, truly, like, con men will tell you that they have, there still is some trial and error. And I think what's interesting, and she says this actually in the game show part of like, you're clearly a skilled, smart guy. Like, why did you not go just get a real career, like do a real thing with the dedication and effort you gave to this? And we see it. We see him, like you said, trying and trying and trying. With the dedication and effort that you gave this, why did you just go be amazing at a real job?
That's your point. He passes the bar exam.
He like passed the bar exam.
Find that out, that he could have been a lawyer.
That's the thing, is it's like, it's not about the skill set for him at a certain point. It's not about, should I have this actual career? It's, can I convince you?
Mm-hmm.
Can I con you? The satisfaction isn't in doing the thing well. The job, the fake job well, being a good lawyer or being a good pilot, it is, did I convince you that I was this thing? Did I trick you the right way? And he doesn't see it as harmful. He sees it as an accomplishment. And he you even see it reflected in the way he writes his letters to his dad, right? He's like very proud of himself. He's like, I'm a pilot now and they tell me I'm doing great and all these things. And he's proud of himself, but he can't write into words the real thing that he's proud of, which is I convinced them. I got them.
I do. Yeah. I think that's a good call because I did write down that the letters to his dad give this really good through line for the film. And right. because it is not, it's not like Wolf of Wall Street where literally the narrator is telling us everything that's happening. We don't get that in this, but we get kind of hints of it and we can kind of laugh where we see what he's really doing. But these letters to his right. dad, he's saying, Dad, I have decided to stop being a pilot. And now I'm going to be a doctor.
I'm going to be a doctor. And now yeah. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be all these things. Yeah.
yeah.
And I think the thing too is that, like, again, we got to keep coming back to the fact that he's a kid when this happens, you know, which is the impetus for this is that his parents are getting divorced and they want to force a choice. Who are you going to live with?
Yeah.
And the lawyer comes in and says, like, this is not a test. This is not a trick. There's no wrong answer. Mm-hmm. And as having been in this exact situation as a kid, I can tell you that that is 100% not true. There is a wrong answer no matter what you do. Right? Like you are hurting someone in this process and there's no way around that. There just isn't. And for them to lie to him as a kid and try to make it seem like it's not a big deal, he knows what a big deal it is and he can't answer the question, right? He just runs away. And I think the thing that is so clear is that he wants someone to chase him and they don't, right? His parents don't chase him. He didn't make a choice. He didn't pick a parent. He couldn't do it. He just wanted them to stay together. And he runs away wanting to be chased and they just trust him to go. They just let him go.
That's an interesting take that I hadn't really considered because, I mean, obviously we do see at the end that his mom is completely moved. I mean, we see it halfway through the movie that she has moved on.
She's a whole new life.
She still cares about him, but like she's got another kid. Like things are good. I hadn't really put that together that they don't seem to be searching for him as much as all the authorities are throughout this film.
I think that's the thing. Like I ran away as a kid more than once and I can tell you, you want someone to come after you.
Like a cry right? for help.
Kind it's of a thing. Cry for help. It's attention grabbing. It is. I need you to see me, feel my pain, understand where I'm coming from, ask me the question, help me with the thing, whatever it is, you want someone to chase you.
Well, if you ever don't show up for pod recording day, I'm going to know what's happening.
You're going to have to chase me and I will know you don't love me if you don't, you know? But that's the thing. I think that's what he's going through is that like nobody is chasing him. And so when Carl starts to chase him, it's the validation that he has been wanting mm-hmm. that whole time. It is, I am important. I am worthy of being chased. I'm worthy of being caught. This man who's paying attention to me. And he bonds with him in that way. And he wants him to keep chasing him until he kind of just gets tired. And he remembers that the thing that he was chasing the whole time is a family.
I wrote that down of like, he just wants his parents back together. Yeah. He tells you over and over,
call mom.
Take this car. Go pick up mom. Yeah.
Go pick up mom. Get her a new outfit. Do this. I got you that. I got you this. He calls and he tells Carl to stop chasing him. He just wants to marry Brenda and have a new life with this new mm-hmm. family. He remembers after years of this and being so tired that he just wanted a family. He just wanted his family to chase him. And now he has found a new family and he just wants to stop. And I think he kind of forgot in all the back and forth of like, I've accomplished this, quote unquote, that he really just wanted a home, wanted a family and wanted to commit to that. And he can't stop it. It's been a run. Now it's a runaway train. You know, yeah. it's gone too far.
Yeah. Out of all the different cons in this, is there one that stands out to you as sort of the most fun to watch take place? I feel like the airline pilot at the beginning gets the most time because it's kind of his first step and then they move quickly through the doctor, the lawyer piece. But is there one that stands out to you the most?
I think the airline pilot one is the sexiest, right? Like what I think this is what I'll say about each, right? Like the airline pilot one is the sexiest one. It's supposed to grab you in, right? It also mm-hmm. feels very harmless, right? Like you see him literally asking for milk from the jump seat on his first flight. You know, he's never
he's
been
not
on a
actually
plane.
Flying the plane, which is
he's
good.
Not flying the plane. He's never been in a plane and his first experience is in the fucking cockpit. Like, imagine how much that would that blow your mind. Like, right. Him just like holding it and, and asking for milk like the kid that he is. Yeah. But it is rooted in this like inherent sexiness of the era and being a pilot and all the ladies you can get and the suave nature that he starts to pick up. Like, he starts to realize his own sexuality and how much he can pull this off. And so I think that's the most fun to watch, because you're watching him grow the most, like, as a person into this persona. The doctor one is funny. I think it's the funnier one, but it is also the scarier one, because you're like, oh shit, you're about to do real damage here. You could do that real one.
I couldn't remember.
Here.
This was only, I think, the second or maybe third time I've seen this movie, and I couldn't remember. I'm like, this one seems the most risky because you might get called in, and of course he does. And thankfully, it's just, you know, not to say for this poor kid with a broken leg, but, you know, he just
it's not
gets the
worst thing that could have happened.
I
thought
he was going to get pulled in for like emergency surgery. And I was like, does he kill somebody? Is that how this ends?
Which, like, literally, there are people who have done this. There have been fake doctors or really terrible doctors. Like, just listen to Dr. Death, guys. Like, it's horrifying. But it is, it tiptoes around that in a way that, like, it's still funny and it's rooted in this romantic story that you get. So you don't have to take it quite as seriously. And then the lawyer one is just farcical. I think that's the progression you're supposed to get, right? Of like, ooh, I can do this. This is sexy. This is fun. This is harmless. Ooh, this is funny, but a little bit scary. And then you get to this next one and you're like, this is some crazy bullshit. Like, there is no, this is outlandish. This is farcical. There's no way. And it's funny because that's the one that's rooted in any kind of truth, that he supposedly actually passed the bar. And again, is indicative for the 13th time about this kid is smart. And if he just put his mind to something, he could really do it. So I think they all have something different is what I would say. And I think they're important to the progression of the story.
Yeah. Janelle and I were talking about how the lawyer one, it's like the one time he can't completely bullshit people, where it's like, lawyers know bullshit.
I know.
They can smell it from a mile
away. They can smell it from a mile away. And the judge fucking calls him out.
Why are you doing this? The defendant isn't even sitting
there. He's like,
there.
There's no jury. There's nothing. There's just me. What the hell is wrong with you? He calls him out.
It's a very good gag to see his confidence in prior to that of presenting everything. And then you turn and it's like an empty room. That's pretty quality.
Totally. But you see no repercussions. Yet again, you see no repercussions. It cuts to the family night where they're watching TV together. They're so wholesome and they're singing together. But you just see that he has like learned everything he needs to know from either of these jobs on TV. Right. And he can't execute them. And then you cut to, again, no repercussions, this family night where he's with his new family. And he like, you know, he starts to sing along to the show, and he's just really leaning into the wholesomeness of that moment. And he's the oddball out. Like, he's still trying, but you can feel what an oddball out he is. But
thankfully, it was like Disney sing along songs. They had the lyrics on the screen for him, so he could catch on eventually.
Oh, he caught on. He's like, and I love that they actually play him singing, and like, no shade. I'm sure Leonardo DiCaprio has a lovely voice, but he's like not supposed to sound good. Yeah. And you like hear his like wonky singing and their little, it feels very authentic is what I would say. But I have to sidebar here. I hate when grown ass people call their parents, oh God, I'm going to get us to one star today. When they call their parents daddy or mommy, like in real life, that bugs the shit out of me. And then on screen, it bugs the shit out of me. And she's calling him daddy. He calls his dad daddy. Again, naive little children. Like, it's a common theme. And then he fucking slaps his hand on his knee and Amy Adams crawls onto his knee during that song. Yeah. And they like cuddle and do this. She's like, oh my God, daddy. And she's like welcomed back into the fold because some man has proposed to her. There are so many things about this scene that make me want to gag. I'm like, the daddy of it all. You're sitting on his knee. You're a grown ass woman. You had an abortion that he made you have, by the way, but you're only an acceptable family member now because this con man conned his way into your family. That scene is just so, there's a lot to unpack
in
that
creepy
scene for me.
It was a different time. We have to say that. It was a different time. You could sit on your daddy's lap whenever you wanted to. It wasn't. But they don't really, I am surprised with you laying it all out that way, that they don't really villainize the Martin Sheen character as much as they could. Like, it's sort of like, oh,
you
this happened.
Like, it could
now
go
we're a happy
there.
Family. Yeah, and it never does.
It never does. Yeah. You do feel like it could go there. And they do try to make him like, you're not sure if he has a read on him. And I like that. I like that tension. Right. I like that tension build.
Too good to be true.
But because of course it's true, but this is where you know he still hasn't perfected his con man-ness, right? Because he's just trying to impress this guy and he just says yes to everything. And if he had said one thing differently, like, oh no, I'm actually not a Lutheran, mm-hmm. I'm Catholic, or like whatever the hell, it would be more authentic than you trying to pretend to be a Lutheran and just to fit into this family. And I think that again is like speaking to his actual relationship oriented desperation than his con skills, because he would rather get in with this family. And that's more important to him than selling the character as well as he probably could have if he wasn't trying to just be everything that they wanted him to be. And yeah, you think that Martin Sheen is going to pick up on it a little bit. You get these tendrils of that. You almost want him to, and then he doesn't. He's just like, nope, love this guy. Yeah, you're romantic, great. Just like me.
Yeah, and then Tom Hanks shows up and ruins it. But and I do, I love the line when he confesses everything to Amy Adams' character and like gives her all the details. He's got the suitcase full of money. He's escaping through the window and her just saying, wait, you're not Lutheran. That line is pretty cool.
I know. That is so, again, incidentally funny. He's great at incidentally funny, where she's just like, her takeaway from all of this is, you're not Lutheran? What? And Lutherans are like famously really nice and friendly and accepting. So I thought that was kind of hilarious. Lots of levels.
I don't want to go too quickly into sort of the climax. I wanted to backtrack a little bit and just say that like one of my favorite scenes in this is the hotel room where they first interact for the first time. Frank and Carl.
Oh, Carl. Yeah. I was like, him. Jennifer Garner, which one? Cause that's a fun scene.
That's
too.
My favorite scene.
I love that scene.
Prostitution. But
escort. She's an escort.
That's what
get it right.
She's 17. Good for her. But yeah, when he catches him in the bathroom and just again that immediate confidence of how do I play this? And he walks out and sees the gun, compliments the gun, pretends.
But don't
to be...
you just want to shake him for letting him keep the wallet?
No, because I think that's the point, right? Is
I mean, I think it moves the plot forward.
Gaining trust of like, hang on to it, I'll see you downstairs. Like, I think it's part of the con.
I think it's a poorly executed con, personally, because there is such risk that the second he walks out of the room, he's going to look at it and then he chases you and catches you. And I think if you're really trying to escape, you genuinely need to get away and you need to allow any loose ends that could potentially catch you not be left behind. And I feel like he took all of his supplies, right? He knew he needed these materials and I'm going to get this evidence where it needs to go. He knew he needed his materials and he needed to fucking book it. And he doesn't take the wallet, which is the only thing in the room that can give him away. And it would be perfectly reasonable to say, oh yeah, thanks man. Grab it, put it away. And you've bought yourself so much more time. So, I mean, maybe it is again, trust building to your point, and I could see that, but I think it's poorly executed of like, you've built
it would have given him a longer fuse for escaping where
and I think
Carl
like,
would be sitting up
Carl
there
Carl could
until
be sitting up there for he'd be like, man, LAPD is not here, it's been 20 minutes, you know, like 30 minutes, whatever. It would just give him more of a lead and maybe make him question like, is that, you know, is this, let me look around, let me dig further, let me like find more evidence, and it's all gone, you know. So I think it's a very interesting thing. I think he has such, again, with the confidence, like he's a gun in his face and he just keeps walking into the fucking room and the guy's telling him, freeze, freeze. He gives no explanation. He's just like, man, he's doing this. He just starts going off. And that is a real like commitment to the bit to a almost detrimental degree, because he doesn't know shit about Carl at this point. He doesn't know whether or not this man will shoot him. And so I think it's also just a little bit indicative of the risks he's willing to take. So to that end, like maybe again with the wallet, like he's okay with living on the edge a little.
Yeah. Like going back to the invincibility of youth, right?
Right.
You just think, no, that there's a gun on me. No, there's nothing bad's going to happen.
No big deal.
I can't die. I'm going to live forever. But Have you, I guess I want to segue from that into my other favorite Carl moment. Have you heard any good knock knock jokes lately, Mackenzie?
Oh my God, this is also my other favorite Carl moment. I just love it. And I love when he re-delivers it later to his boss, who's like, hey, don't let this drag you down. You could be section chief. And he's like, would you like me to tell you a joke? Knock knock. I just, and it's so, and cut away. I love it. It's so funny. And I think it's so indicative of this person's character that he just wants to catch the guy. Like, he's not being ambitious about it. He is, because he could, they've said, you wrote the book on check fraud. You wrote the book on bank fraud, rather. But you can be section chief if you want to, you know, you're good to go. And he's like, no, I have to catch this guy. Like, that's the thing that he cares the most about. And I think it speaks again. We've talked about like what Frank needs. He needs to be chased. He needs people to care about him. He needs to win people over and get the con across and all of that. Carl needs an obsession. Carl needs a distraction. Carl doesn't have a family, right? Like, what he also is lacking family. And this is his life. This job is his life. This chase on the other end of it is also his life. And he has to chase this guy and he has to catch this guy.
Yeah, it's a different type of ambition where he's not worried about moving up the ladder. He's ambitious about accomplishing whatever his goal is at that time. And we get some of his backstory, and I kind of like that they leave it vague, but we do find out that he's estranged from his family. And I think that ties into he's spending too much time on the job. He can't turn off all these sort of tropey stuff. And I'm glad we don't have to directly address it as much.
Yeah. And I think, like, to your point, it's all about the goal, like you said. And then I also agree with you. And we talked about this a little bit in Jurassic Park of not going too far into the character backstory, but giving you enough that you understand the motivations or you understand the interactions that are at play. And I think that's what they do with Carl very well of like, I have enough information here to understand why he's motivated to do X, Y, Z. And I can go with this. Like, I don't need a ton of detail. And I like how he explains himself later too, when this comes up.
You saying that made me think of how when they're on the plane and he asks him how he passed the bar exam for the first time. And he's like, give me the other half of that eclair. And he just houses
He's
like, I don't really fucking care that much. Like, you're not going to have, this is not, you're not going
to. He's like, I already caught you. Okay. Yeah. Like, I did the thing I was here to do. Like, yes, this would be a nice nugget, but no, you don't get my eclair. And I love, it's so funny you say that. That's one of my favorite moments. And also just his little like wink at the end when he does it of like, he like really rubs it in, you know what I mean? He's really like, this is delish. The commitment to that I really like. No. I also like with the two of them though, really quick, that I love the juxtaposition prior to him being caught of their lifestyles, right? Of like, this is a kid who is in a luxury hotel with a luxury car and the finest silks and money coming out of his ears and driving a red Cadillac and doing all these things. And he's having this beautiful experience. He's explaining to his dad why the salad fork is chilled, right? Like, this is a guy who's a man about town at this point. Cut to Carl in the laundromat with his clothes being turned pink by the red sweater of all the women around him who are there doing laundry, and he's the only guy because he's single and his wife isn't around and whatever. All the implications of that scene are subtle, but so profound and so well juxtaposed against, you know, what Frank's life is at this point.
It is cool to see those two back to back and to see them in the different stages of their lives and the way that they sort of mirror each other. Maybe not mirror isn't the right word, but when it comes to Christmas time, this kid who we think has this luxurious lifestyle is alone on Christmas and is calling this guy who's trying to catch him, to your point earlier. So, and Carl calls that out of, you don't have anybody else to call. That's why you're calling me.
And it's funny. And he makes fun of him, but guess what? Neither does Carl.
Yeah. He's by himself too.
And that's the thing. I think like, you see in other people, the things that are true in you, and Carl sees in Frank their similarities and that they are both alone on Christmas. Right. And so he recognizes that so easily and he rubs it in, but it's like, you like turn that mirror around a little bit, buddy. Like, you're both in the same situation. You are foils of each other, but you have these like core things that are very similar and why you're both on this ride together, basically.
Yeah, I think it becomes for sure sort of a maybe not father-son dynamic, but there is something there for them, especially when we come to the ending and how they sort of end up working together And even when he tries to run away again, he calls him out on it. He's just like, nobody's chasing anymore. Why would you run? You know?
Yeah.
So I do,
which
think
is saying something, because he has hung his reputation and all right. of his favors on this guy coming out of prison. So I think he also has maybe a little bit of confidence in that. Maybe Frank has this drive and this innate need to be chased and all of these things. And if you just take away, it's like a bully, right? If you take the thing away that they want, the chasing, does it mean the same thing to them anymore? And are they right. going to make the same decisions anymore? And I think he's figured out, I can't keep chasing him because that's exactly what he wants. And that's why he comes back, I think. And he finds a new and different, very different life, and they become good friends, which is kind of something that I think flows nicely. You wouldn't necessarily assume that, but I feel like it works. It makes sense at the end of it all.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's one component of not the very end, but the last 20, 30 minutes that I don't love, which is I feel like Frank spirals a little too quickly in the last 30 minutes of the movie. Like,
oh, his like harried French, yeah, Mal Richard, like Prince guy.
Papers going everywhere. Oh, yeah, he's going bonkers. That feels like a cool scene, but I don't feel like that is earned as much.
That is the most disconnected to his character he's ever been. I mean, I think that they were trying to show that he was starting to crack. There are subtle allusions to it earlier where he's calling Carl and saying, please stop chasing me. Mm-hmm. Like, he is tired. He has a little bit of a breakdown with Brenda. There's that little segue of like, okay, a little nugget he's starting to crack. He has the thing at the airport where he's like ready to risk it all to go and escape with her, but she's not ready to go. And he's just on the edge. You do see these multiple moments where he's on the edge. And I think that is supposed to be that moment in Mont Richard is supposed to be the culmination of all those miniature breaks. And this is his full blown breakdown. But I agree. I think it is still like, if not 0 to 60, it's like 20 to 60, mm-hmm. You know, you're just like, ooh, that came quick and dirty. And I feel like, yeah, he's not quite to that level of breakdown. They're like, he's running out of money. How is he running out of money? Like, he has so much money that it feels, yeah, a little unearned, a little early for that, for sure.
Completely agree. And I think we've touched on, I think, all the other components of how this wraps up. The airplane escape sequence is fun. I love Carl climbing into the toilet, the hollowed out toilet opening, and like, Frank, like that part is a cool visual and kind of representative of this entire film. But then when he goes to his mom, his old home, and like sees his mom there, is it his old home?
It's his mom's new home with Jack. So it's not the same house, but it's the new home with Jack. And I think that's more painful. And yeah, he just is like, get me away from this. Like, I got to get out of here. And it makes sense.
It's the one time he gives himself over so willingly. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. And I think like you're supposed to feel how heartbreaking that is for him too. Right. To just see that he's been totally replaced. And I think it's supposed to bring you back to a place of sympathy for him of like, don't forget that he was a kid. Don't forget that this was all predicated on the breakdown of his family. Don't forget that his family really didn't come for him and just moved on. And they did. And
or even adding to that of who his dad was, at least according to this iteration, it's like, oh, would I have grown up differently if I had a different father with the same mom? This kid seems to be doing just fine.
What would have happened if Jack Barnes was his dad and not Frank, right? Like there is something to that, right? This house is stable. That man is truly a lawyer. Like they have a kid and they're safe and secure and all these things. And I think it's the almost of that is very hard for him to see and feel. And I think you're supposed to feel that with him and with them.
I'd agree.
Oh, okay. Well, I think it's still just, even with all the annoyance on rewatch of the things that we have been conned into believing were real cons, so to speak, it still holds up as just like a great film, a fun watch, incredible performances. All that to say, what is your rating?
This is the rare occasion where I'm going to make you go first because I'm very curious to see where you fall.
I hate going first. That's why I always ask you.
No, but you feel much more strongly on this one than I do.
I do. I think I really did struggle, like I said, on rewatch with the inaccuracies of it all. Because as you know more than most, I like deep dive research all the things that I watch. So I did that again. And that was hard. So I didn't enjoy it as much. Like I said, the thing I felt the most this time though was the drag of it. I think there are some pacing issues here. I think that's true across the film, regardless of whether or not the content is real. I think there's some pacing issues. Talking it through reminded me of some of the themes to the story that I think are very well executed, actually. And the way the characters are played off of each other and the sentimentality of the story. And like, it's very Steven Spielberg for me too, of like, these are the kinds of stories he likes to tell, and he does them really well. So I think it kind of redeemed it for me as well. So I think I would probably land at like a 7.5.
Okay. Maybe
leaning 8. Like, I still think it's a really good movie. I wish I didn't know all the other shit, and I think I would maybe even go higher because it's a really good time.
Okay. I'm surprised you came in that low, because I thought I was going to come in low. But you said something, and it made me think talking about this movie is kind of more interesting to me than watching the movie. And I'm not saying that to say it's a bad movie.
No.
But hearing some of your theories and talking about sort of the family aspects and different made it more interesting. But I still just, I can't get over, even if I were to watch this and assume it's 100% fiction, false, and watch it as, and just see the entertainment value, I do think something's taken away, to your point of the slowness of this. That, to me, knowing that it's true makes that more acceptable. If I know that it's all made up and you can make it as interesting as you want, just fucking tell me he invented jetpacks at some point. He's flying around the jetpack. Yeah. That'd be awesome. We get a little monster sequence with Godzilla.
Spielberg didn't know that it wasn't true. Like, we gotta remember.
I know.
That.
Again, I'm not going to hold that against him. So when I first saw this, I would probably have given it like an 8. It's not a perfect film, but it was highly enjoyable. I'm going to drop it to 7, just knowing what I do know. And like, I don't particularly want to rewatch. I might rewatch this at some point in my life, but
I'll totally rewatch this. I think, well, let me rephrase. If I didn't know all of that, I would rewatch this over and over. I've seen this movie a million times. I love it. But yeah, now can I rewatch it without thinking through all that? I don't know. That's a great question. But yeah, that's like, we're closer than we thought. I think like, again, on first watch, I would have, probably easily given it an 8.5, you know, which I think is in line with reviews at the time.
Right.
All right, guys. Well, I think the moral of the story is this is still a really great movie. And if you don't dissect it for Jesus, like we just did, then you probably will have a great time. Just watch it as fiction. Just watch it.
The moral of the story was don't fucking lie. You'll probably have a great time, apparently. You'll be a millionaire.
I was going to say, you can have like a really solid run, actually, if you lie. But it won't last, though. It won't last.
And you won't have a family. So
and you won't have a family, except your FBI bro. Well, thanks for joining us, guys. Hope you enjoyed it. Come back next week for more Spielberg fun. We're going to be switching gears a little bit. I think we keep switching gears, which I like with his filmography, like we said. We're going to do Hook next week.
Oh boy. Another 90s classic, right?
I think so. I think early it's 90s, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Robin Williams makes an appearance. It's a good time. I highly recommend watching Before the Ep if you get a chance, because it's a good one. It's a fun one.
Yeah. And in the meantime, you can follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things. Instagram, TikTok. You can now watch us with video on YouTube, Spotify. Give us some subscribes, some comments. We're already getting some. Appreciate that.
We're getting so many little comments on YouTube. And I started a poll. I don't even know if you saw this. I did a poll on our Spotify app and we got some responses. And yeah, so thanks for engaging, guys.
Yeah, if you guys keep watching and commenting on YouTube, I might get a fancier ring light and some more interesting outfits. We'll see.
Yeah, tell him to up his outfit game, y'all. I like try to dress on theme, and this kid does not meet me where we're at.
Still rocking like a Halloween shirt.
I had my thesaurus shirt for Jurassic Park. Like, come on. Get Lamar to step up his game, y'all. No, I'm just kidding. We're having a great time. Thank you for joining us and being with us. And for now, go have a drink. And watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.